Please remain standing together as we hear together the reading of the scripture, which comes from Psalm chapter 10. You know, Psalm's supposed to be read with emotion, but I don't think I'm going to be able to do it, so just try to imagine. I'll do my best. Why, O Lord, do you stand afar away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In arrogance, the wicked hardly pursue the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised. For the wicked boasts of the desires of his soul, and the one greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. In the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. His ways prosper at all times. Judgment are on high, out of his sight. As for all his foes, he puffs at them. He says in his heart, I shall not be moved. Throughout all generation, I shall not meet adversity. His mouth is filled with cursing and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue are mischief and iniquity. He sits in ambush in the villages. In hiding places, he murders the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the helpless. He lurks in ambush like a lion in a thicket. He lurks that he may seize the poor. He seizes the poor when he draws him into his net. The helpless are crushed, sink down, and fall by his might. He says in his heart, God has forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will never see it. Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand. Forget not the afflicted. Why does the wicked renounce God and say in his heart, you will not call to account? But you do see, for you note mischief and vexation, that you may not take it into your hands. To you the helpless commit himself. You have been the helper of the fatherless. Break the arm of the wicked and evildoer. Call his wickedness to account till you find none. The Lord is king forever and ever. The nations perish from his land. O Lord, you hear the desire of the afflicted. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed, so that the man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. Please be seated.
Sorry about that. Like many of us today, I grew up in the church, going to church with my parents. If I think back upon it, and I think about my days going to youth group through junior high, even into high school, I realize this, that a lot of it for me was emotionally driven. And not that being emotionally driven is always such a bad thing, but I realized that I was more emotionally driven without much understanding. It was so much the case that towards the end of high school, I just had a lot of questions. My parents would actually do family worship once in a while, and that's what we do when we get together with my parents and my siblings, and my dad would lead like a prayer and a Bible study, and he would also give us opportunity to ask questions. I would ask questions like this. If the Bible is true, how come it doesn't mention dinosaurs in Genesis? And of course, they're not prepared to give me an answer, so they wouldn't really give me one. And I thought there was something wrong with that. I had questions later on, and I would ask things like, well, you know, if God created Adam and Eve, why did he create Adam and Eve if he knew they were going to sin? Why didn't he just, you know, not make them at all? Or why didn't he fix them? You know, and of course, my parents, they weren't really prepared to give me an answer to that question either, and I thought that was something wrong with that. And so towards the end of my high school, even as I went to my first year in college, I stopped going to church. I realized, you know what, I'm not sure about this stuff. I don't know if I can continue to do this with a clear conscience. And I became a philosophy major, of all things. I was a philosophy major for the first 2 years of college. And I remember my first philosophy class, my professor was an atheist. And when I looked up to him, I looked up to him a lot because his first class, in three simple points, he explained why he thought God didn't exist. I was like, wow, why didn't anyone tell me this growing up in youth group? Why didn't anyone share this with me? I didn't know about this stuff. And for the next few years after that, I just stopped going to church altogether. I just didn't want to, like, deal with it. It was an intellectual issue with me in the beginning. And so I was so set on becoming a philosophy major. The only thing was my professor told me later on that, it shouldn't be one, because philosophy majors and professors actually have a high depression rate, and so their suicide rate is pretty high. And so I said, oh, okay, maybe I shouldn't be. I also failed the final exam in the philosophy class. In one of the classes there, these essay questions were there, and the final question on this final exam was simply this: why? Why? That was it. Why? I was like, what is this question supposed to mean? And so the only thing I could think of is I tried to put everything that I knew, everything that I remember from class, I just wrote it all down. You know, when you don't really know the question, you just put everything else you know and hopefully you get some points. That's what I did, and I got it all wrong. I failed the exam. I talked to a fellow classmate. I asked him, what did you put? What did you put for that question? He says this. The question was why. He answered, why not? And he got it right. He got it right. And I thought that was the silliest thing. I mean, this is just so silly. But yet, that's how philosophy people sometimes get. And as simple as that answer might sound, why and why not, this is what I realized. Out of all the questions, now that I'm a pastor, out of all the questions that I've had that begin with words like who, what, when, where, I think it's the why questions that are the most difficult. Not because just that they are intellectually difficult, but also because why questions tend to also be personally difficult. Because why questions, if you have a why question, it's never just intellectual. There's always a personal element, especially when you have why questions that come out of real, hard, or frustrating, or difficult personal experiences, even things like suffering. Why am I like this? Why does he or she have to be like this? Why can't I change this in my life? Why am I always like this? Why is this happening to me right now? Why? Why can't I have children? Why can't I have better children? Why can't I have a better job? Why am I always grinding out, trying to make ends meet? Why? Why can't I have better health? Why does my family have to always be sick? Why can't I be more successful in life while it seems like everybody else around me enjoying their success? And we have bigger why questions. Why is there so much evil in the world? Why does it seem like bad people get away with stuff, win big, and it seems like good people always suffer or lose out? Why is it that a white college athlete who commits a rape crime gets a slap on a wrist and a few months of community service, and a black man gets sentenced to years in jail for just carrying marijuana? Why? Why did 9/11 have to happen? Today's 9/11, right? Why? What was the point of all that? And the thing is this, I don't have much of a problem with why bad things happen. Because there's bad people. There's bad people, and bad people do bad things, and that's why bad things happen. In fact, sometimes I think there's more bad people than there are good people. There isn't anything we deserve in terms of good. Sometimes I ask, maybe the question ought to be, why do good things happen at all? Why do good things happen? But the thing is, when good things happen to you, you never ask why. Why? Why did I win the lottery? Why did I win this lottery? Why did I get this? Bless you. No one says that. But when bad things happen, we ask why. But the thing that I have a problem with is this. Not that bad things happen in the world or in my life, but that there seems to be a disproportionate distribution of bad things. Why do bad things always seem to happen to relatively good people? And that good things seem to happen to relatively bad people or people worse than me. And if I bring these things to God, and if I ask God why, if he's there, if there is a God, what's he thinking? Why are you letting this happen? Why can't you do any better? If you understand this sentiment, if you've ever asked these kind of questions for yourself in your own personal life, then you get a glimpse into what the psalm here in Psalm chapter 10 is feeling. He's frustrated. He opens up this chapter with why questions. Why are you hiding your face from me? Why are you not here? Why are you letting the wicked and the bad look like they prosper? And why are you not addressing the poor and the afflicted? Where is your justice? Why are you doing this? That's the frustration of the psalm here. We ask these questions ourselves. You know, my father was one of those Korean fathers who immigrated in 1972. Very strong, probably like many of your fathers, just very strong, very stubborn. Came with, like, and he tells me the story every time. He came to the States with like $300 with his wife, my mother, who was pregnant with me, and they were students, graduate students at the University of Utah. He worked at a part-time at a grocery store bagging groceries while he went to school to get his PhD. And while my mother watched two kids later on and babysitted someone else's kid just to make ends meet. And so he was just one of those guys that he would just grind it out. He just said, look, if you really want something, you just do it, and you could do it. And he just did it, and he put himself out there, and he eventually got his degree, eventually got a good job, sent us to school, sent us to college, and so forth. And then one day, as he was in the company of Bausch & Lomb, the pharmaceutical company, he was the director of research and development back in New Jersey, in South Jersey. And what happened was Bausch & Lomb went through some financial difficulties, and so they had to close down that company. He would have to leave. He always told himself he could make more money if he just got out of the pharmaceutical industry and went into business. He always knew that business was where the money was. The problem with my dad was he has no experience of business at all. He wanted to open a convenience store, thinking that he was going to make a lot more money than he was doing now. But he had no experience. It didn't matter. My Korean father said, it's okay. If I do it, if I just put my mind to it, I can do it. And I'm going to do it for the family. So he moves down to Florida. He buys a convenience store that was owned by a bunch of Hispanics in the middle of this barren highway that had customers who were Mexicans picking strawberries in a field nearby. That was his customer. It was a broken down shack, and he had to be there every day from 4 a.m. to literally 12 a.m. every day. He didn't realize how hard it was going to be. It was so bad that as I was doing youth ministry in New York, I thought, well, you know what, maybe I should go down and help him. But he said, no, I can handle it. I can handle it. And so, okay, fine. Anyways, on Christmas holiday, I go down to visit for a couple of weeks, and there he was, so tired. At the end of the day, he's on the couch counting the cash, the revenue that had just come in for the day. He falls asleep on the couch counting his money because he's so tired. He goes back to his bed, and in this bedroom was literally right across the hallway from where I was sleeping. In the middle of the night, I hear this big thud. Right? I get up quickly. I'm startled. I run into the room, and there's my father, my Korean dad, lying on the floor, grabbing his leg. The only thing he could say was this, I can't feel my legs. So me thinking, well, he probably just bumped his leg or something. I got down, and I started massaging it. I said, it'll be all right. It'll be all right. He has this look of shock. For the first time in my life, in my dad, I saw fear. And so I got scared. And so I started praying. After all, I was a part-time youth group director in my church. I was a Christian. I started praying. I said, Lord, heal my dad. Lord, make this okay. I started rebuking the devil. I started doing all these kinds of things. My mother came upstairs. She's like, what's going on? I told my mom, we need to call the ambulance. So she calls the ambulance. Nothing. He was paralyzed right on the right side of his body. He had a stroke while he was sleeping. He goes to bed healthy, wakes up, he can't move his body. Now, that's tough enough, but think of the mental hardship that someone who thought they could do anything, the pride that they have, now they can't move. I had to carry my dad to the restroom to use the toilet. And then I had to carry him on my back, 200-pound man, down the stairs to the ambulance. And the whole time I'm thinking, why? Why? God, I'm giving my life to serve you. My dad's done nothing wrong. My mom's been pretty good. I'm dedicating my life to you. Why are you letting this happen? Why aren't you answering my prayer? And I didn't get really an answer. When we ask the question why, like the psalmist does, this is an encouragement and this is a more of a teaching here. I want to give you two ways to do it, okay? Because I know all of you struggle this way or will struggle one day like this. Two things, two questions to ask when you have these kind of questions in life. Remember this, who are you asking and how are you asking? When you have why questions, remember this, who are you asking and how are you asking? Very important. So let me look at that really carefully with you here, okay? As I prepare this sermon, I realize it's way too long, so I actually cut it short because I'm going to finish the next half maybe next week. But so let's just look at this. Who are you? Who are we asking? And how are you asking? Here's the hard line. This is the hard line, okay? So just bear with me. People ask why to God in the Bible. They ask Paul in Romans chapter 9, God, Paul, why does God love Jacob, but he doesn't like Esau? And what's Paul's answer? Romans chapter 9. Oh man, who are you to reply to God? Will the thing formed say to him who formed it, why have you made me like this? Does not the potter have power over the clay from the same lump to make one vessel for honor and another for dishonor? That was his answer. In the book of Job, Job was the most righteous man in the land, it says. Job lost his family, Job lost his job, Job lost his land, and he's asking why? Why? And there's no answer until the very end of the book of Job, in chapter 38, God gives him an answer. And what does he say? He says this, were you there when I created the earth? Tell me if you understand. Were you there when I marked off its dimensions? Surely you must know. Who stretched out the measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? While the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy, where were you? Have you journeyed the springs of the sea? Have you walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. That was Job's answer. What are these responses? God is telling both Paul and Job and us is this. Who are you asking? He's the creator. He's the creator of the universe. If there is a God, it must mean he's a creator. And if there's a creator, that means you're his creature. That means you were created. This is a fundamental relationship, whether you believe or not, that we believe every human being has, that God has created us and we are his creatures. It's what we call the creator-creature distinction. And when we remember this distinction, this relationship, when you have questions like why, who do you think you're asking? Because sometimes we think big questions. We have big questions. Sometimes we ask out of anger. Sometimes we ask out of frustration. Sometimes we ask out of disappointment. And we are reminded here by God in these couple of passages, who do you think you're talking to? Will the formed, or the one thing formed say to him who formed it, why have you made me like this? Doesn't the potter have the right to do with his clay? He's the creator. And here's the point. This is the hard line, okay? Let me just get this out of the way. He's the creator. What makes you think he's obliged to give you, his creature, an answer? And secondly, here's the second point of this portion. You know, those of you who have kids, like we do, and you tell your kids, hey, can you take out the trash? Why? Can you do your homework now? Why? Can you clean up your room? Why? Doesn't it get frustrating that you as a parent, if you're doing this, that you have to sit down and ask your kid or explain to your kid why all the time? Does that work? Your boss tell you to do something and you say why? Does he sit down with you to explain why you've got to do this? When your kid asks you why, sometimes the answer that you need to hear is this, because I said so. Why? Because that is the nature of the relationship. That is the nature of a parent to a child. There's an inherent authority there. That is the nature of a boss to an employee. There's an inherent authority there. And if those are true of human relationships, then if there's a creator and if there's a creature, that's the nature of the relationship. You're finite. You're limited. The creator, if he's there, he's infinite. He's unlimited. Even if God could give you a full answer to your question, why, what makes you think you would understand? How does the finite comprehend the infinite? It's all baby talk anyways. You know how when you talk to little kids, oh, hey, you know, how are you? How is school? Everything we know about God now is because God baby talked it to us. That's how it works. And besides, I've never met a person going through hurt and pain and suffering, frustration, asking why, and I give them a possible answer, and they respond, oh, okay, that makes sense. I feel so much better. They're still in pain. They're still hurting. They're still suffering. Okay? So remember that. Who are we asking? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying, therefore, you should never ask. But the real question is this. Here's the second point. How are you asking then? You remember who you're asking, but you need to remember how you're asking. And there's three things I want you to remember if you have these questions. One, you got to be careful how you're asking. Number two, you got to be genuine in how you're asking. And number three, you got to be faithful in your asking. Okay? Be careful, be genuine, be faithful in your asking. First of all, look at this. Be careful how you're asking. Why should you be careful how you're asking? It's not just because of who you're asking. God is the creator, you're his creature, and so you need to be careful. It's not just that. But if you're a Christian today, or if you're thinking about becoming a Christian, what's at stake when you're questioning why is your relationship to God? If faith is not strong, you will push logic and reason too far. And the danger in that kind of situation is not that you make judgments about who God is, but that you make judgments when you don't really have maybe sufficient grounds or information to make grounds or to make judgments on God. C.S. Lewis, who was a Christian, author of the Chronicles of Narnia, went through a period of doubt. It happened when his wife passed away. He wrote a book on it called A Grief Observed. And this is what he says in the middle of his darkness, in the middle of his doubts. He says this, quote, "Not that I think I am in much danger of ceasing to believe in God. The real danger is in coming to believe such dreadful things about him. The conclusion I dread," Lewis says, "is not, so there is no God after all. The conclusion I dread is, so this is what God is really like. Deceive yourself no longer," end quote. When we have questions why, we need to be careful how we ask, because it's not about thinking too much. It's about thinking about too much the wrong way. When this happens, we get tempted. We get tempted to doubt. Now, listen carefully. Doubt is not always a bad thing. Literally, the word doubt comes from the Latin word dubiter. It means double. It means you're kind of flipping back and forth, and you haven't really landed anywhere yet. Doubt in this way is an opportunity to resolve that doubt and land on the right side, right? But there is a doubting that's not so innocent. There are times we choose to doubt because we can't get the answers we really want or need. Why am I suffering? Why am I going through this? Why am I in the dark? And when we ask like this, not necessarily looking for answers, but doubting then is our subtle way of making an explanation for those unanswerable questions. You see, at the root of faith, there are two basic problems that we need to really think about: the existence of God and the character of God. Is God there? Is God good? And if we're hurting, if we're struggling, and we can't get an answer from God, the best way to get back at God is to doubt his existence or doubt his goodness. And then you have a picture of God in which you can throw all the blame. Doubt becomes a counterfeit answer to your suffering and your hardship. Because if God is like this, he's to blame. It's your fault, God. You're the one. So the danger is not that we are just tempted to doubt when we ask in the wrong way. Not in the sense that we stop believing that there is a God. But the danger is that we may be tempted to believe in what God is not. The danger is that if we press a judgment too far, our speculation creates a distorted picture of a God that we just can't continue to believe in good faith. It happens. Your faith is at stake. That's why we need to be careful. Eli Wiesel, who was a devout Jewish boy, wrote in his book, Auschwitz in Night. He was a Hungarian-born Jew, and he recollects his early childhood as a Jew in Auschwitz, that German death camp. Now, if you think you have hardship, if you think you're struggling, imagine what it's like to be in his shoes back then. He was a man of faith, right? But this is what happened to him. This is what he says in his book, quote, "Never shall I forget that night, the first night in camp, which has turned my life into one long night, seven times cursed, seven times sealed. Never shall I forget those flames which consume my faith forever. Never shall I forget the nocturnal silence which deprived me for all eternity of the desire to live. Never shall I forget those moments which murdered my God and my soul and turned my dream to dust. Never shall I forget these things, even if I'm condemned to live as long as God himself, never. End quote. He struggled with his faith. And so we need to be careful how we're asking. Our relationship with God is at stake. Okay? So be careful how you're asking. Second thing, how do we ask? Be genuine in your asking. Having said all this, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you should never ask why. Why? Because the Bible, people are always asking why. Our passage, he's asking why. And it's very real. It's very genuine. He doesn't really hold back. He's crying out, where are you gone? You're far away. Why are you far away? And God's ignoring him. He's expressing, the psalmist here in chapter 10 is expressing not a theological reality, but his personal feeling. That's why Psalms is a good devotion place if you're looking for a place to read in the Bible. It's not just theological, but it's very personal. And in verse 11, he says, God, you've forgotten. You've forgotten. He actually accuses God of having a weak memory, indifferent to injustice and what's going on in the world. That's blasphemy. But he's sharing this. I'm surprised how many times David and people in the Bible and the psalm writers question God in a genuine but yet real way. Why, O Lord, do you stand away? Why do you hide yourself? Psalm 10, right? Why have you forgotten me? Psalm 42. Why do you forget those who are hurting and those who are oppressed? Psalm 44. How long, O God, are my enemies going to scoff at me? Is the enemy to revile your name forever? Psalm 74. In the book of Job, why are you doing all this? Why are you doing this? In the book of Habakkuk, God, your people are idolatrous. Why are you just letting them go like this? Why? Why? So there are plenty of places in the Bible where you find people genuinely, but yet carefully sharing their frustrations and the questions of why. They challenge God about what he's doing on their own lives and the struggles that they're facing as they look around them. And what does that mean? It means this. At the very least, it tells us this. That there is real anguish. That there is real frustration, pain, and there is real suffering. And God is not diluting this for you. He's not saying, don't tell me at all. There is a genuine asking. Now here's a side note. If you ever have a friend or a loved one coming to you with their problems and issues, coming to ask you why. Why would God, and you fill in the blank, ... Why would God do this? What you need to remember is this. It's never just a theological question. It's also a personal question. And sometimes the worst thing you could do is to try and give that person an answer, to explain their pain with a theological response that many of us try to do. Oh, don't worry. You know, God is making you stronger. It's the fire that you're going through and he's going to make you stronger. Or, no, Romans chapter 8, God is making everything work for the good of those who love him, and so he'll make it work. Or worse, you say, no, God is the creator. You can't ask that question. Now, these things might be true. They might be true. But does it work? Of course not. What have you done? You've belittled their pain. You've belittled their suffering. And maybe that's why God doesn't just give an answer off the bat. Notice in Psalm 10, though, the psalmist asks why in the beginning, but again, if you read the whole passage, there's no answer given to him. And yet God doesn't just want you to shut up. He's the creator, but he's also the father, like we learned last week from Psalm 88. He's not just a talker, he's a listener. He has ears, and he has ears to hear the cries of his people. He wants to be someone who can empathize with you or who can be someone you can turn to in your time of need. And so we need to be careful how we ask. We need to know who we ask. And also, it's okay to genuinely ask these questions. Why? And it's okay to listen too. Okay? So how should you ask? Be careful. Be genuine. But here, lastly and most importantly, be faithful. Be faithful in your asking. It's amazing how the psalmists are so open in their questioning of God. You know, it's funny. You may have complaints about me, right? I'm too sarcastic. I'm too mean. I'm not affectionate enough. You know, I'm boring. I don't play any sports. I'm too nerdy. I don't know. Whatever you quit. But you're not going to come up to me directly and complain in my face, right? You're not going to do that. You'll just talk behind my back with other people, and I'll just hear about it. That's how it usually works. It's fine, all right, because my identity is in Jesus Christ, all right? He loves me, and it doesn't matter if you did or not. But having said that, guess who will come up to me and complain? My kids. My kids will do it.
Dad, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't say that. That's not a Christian thing to do. Dad, you shouldn't steal. You shouldn't. You know, that's not a Christian thing to do. Shut up, boy. I'm the father. Shut up, girl. No, Dad, you know, they'll complain. They'll complain. They'll say it. Why? Why? Because there's a special relationship there. Father to son, father to daughter, father to, you know, husband to wife, that only they have, and they can do this. And I think that's why the psalmist feels he could say and be genuine in his asking, why, God, what are you doing? Right? That's what he does. But as you keep reading this psalm and all the other psalms, there's a pattern. Even as they question and challenge God, almost every psalm, these guys still remain convinced that God is still good. And they show this by finishing off the psalm with an affirmation of God's character. In our psalm today, first, the psalmist asks, why, O God, are you far away? Why are you not doing anything? Why do you hide yourself? But in verse 16 and onward, he concludes by saying, the Lord is King forever and ever. You see, while the psalmists are having these questions, big questions, serious questions, he still trusts in God. Now, how do you do that? How do you do this? He asks why, but he asks faithfully. And this is how. It's an issue of faith. What does faith do? What faith does is this. Face to face with mystery, face to face with unanswered questions, face to face with evil, faith trusts where it doesn't always understand. Faith does not know why in terms of the immediate, but faith knows why it trusts in God in terms of the ultimate. You see, when we think about who God is, especially in an immediate circumstance, the way we do it is this, as if we are looking into a room, but only through the keyhole of the door. And as you look through the keyhole of the door, you see real pieces, you see real things going on, but you don't see the whole picture. And yet we are so tempted to make a judgment based on what we see through that keyhole. People are finite. The world is now fallen, so life will contain many mysteries. And at times, it's like we see it through a keyhole, only partially. But the truth is, you and I always have sure and sufficient reasons for knowing why we can still trust God, but do not always know what God is doing and why. When you ask these questions with faith, what do you do practically? This is what you do. You suspend judgment. You suspend judgment. You say, Father, I don't understand you, but I trust you. You don't say, I don't understand you at all, but I trust you anyway. Rather, you're saying, I'm not sure what you're doing here, why you're doing this in this situation, but I understand why I trust you anyway. Oswald Chambers, in his book of prayer, explains this. He says, when I'm going on God in his path, I do not understand, but God does. Therefore, I understand God, but not his path. Here's where when we ask that faith needs to work. And the way it works is that it has to suspend judgment on what God is doing. It works by saying we don't always know why, but we trust in a God who does know why. Jesus said, I'm the light of the world. No follower of mine shall wander in the dark. He doesn't say, no follower of mine will never walk in the dark. He says, you won't wander in the dark. He's trustworthy. Now you might be thinking and responding to me, and you might be saying, hey, that's easy for you to say. Tell that to Eli Weisel, who lost his faith in Auschwitz and under that terrible suffering in that German internment camp. How do you keep your faith and ask why in that kind of situation? It is possible. You know, they excavated one of the Jewish internment prisoner camps during World War II. They went into one of these cells, and on the wall of one of the cells was a three-line poem scratched on the wall by a victim of the Holocaust. A three-line poem, and it read like this. I believe in the sun, even when it is not shining. I believe in love, even when I cannot feel it. I believe in God, even when he is silent. That's what was written. It is possible to ask why and still trust. Now, how can I be sure that God is there and that he is good? How about this? Because of another Jew. A Jew not in his youth, but in his prime. Not under compulsion, but freely.
took himself upon himself the full desolation of God's silence. So that as he hung out on the cross, as he died on the cross, guess what he did? He asked why. The Son of God asked why. Why have you forsaken me? Why have you forsaken me? And he only heard silence. That cry, Jesus, my God, why have you forsaken me, is the ultimate silence. We will never fathom the depth of that silence. But the point is this, it teaches us one thing. None of us can sink so low that God himself has not gone lower still. He endured suffering in our place, but he knew and he felt in the deepest way what it was like to ask why and not be answered. He experienced those questions personally himself so that he might restore us to the Father, so that when we experience them, we can be sure that God is there and that he is good, because he himself went ahead of us and experienced for us what we cannot handle. He went through torture on that cross to ultimately deal with all the pain and suffering and injustice and sin. I mean, think about this. If God could take care of everything bad with a snap of his fingers, I think he would, other than having to give up his only son. That's how serious the issue was. And although we don't know why he does things in every immediate situation, we can still trust in a God who ultimately knows why, because of what he's already proven to us in his son. He seems far away from us in our times of hardship and suffering, but he's still the God and the Father of our Lord Jesus, who in Matthew 28 said, remember, I have all the power and authority, and I am still with you. When you have questions like why, like the psalmist does, remember who you're asking. He's the Creator, but he's also your Father. And remember how you're to ask. Be careful. Be genuine. Be faithful. Trust not in the answers to the whys, but trust in God who does know why. Don't just look to God for your answers. Look to God for him, to lean on him, to pray to him, and to trust in him. Let's pray.